We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate, and 5-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, your host, along with my co-host this week, Muse co-founder Ariel Garten. Before we get started, a reminder to check out our free meditations on Muse or Meditation Studio. And if you and your family want to learn to meditate while you're at home or just deepen your practice, use the discount code MUSESTRESSLESS for your Muse headband at choosemuse.com. We're thinking of all of you and wishing you the very best. Now on to today's episode with Ariel.
Thanks, Patricia. This week, we're going to go on an adventure with consciousness explorer Jeff Warren. He's the author of the book, The Head Trip, and the New York Times bestseller, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. He's also a fantastic meditation teacher and the founder of the Consciousness Explorers Club, where he helps you investigate various states of mind. So get ready to strap on your pith helmets and take out your flashlights, because we're going to shine them into the darkest corners of the mind. Welcome, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure. It's fantastic to have you here. So today you're going to be our guide into the brain. Can you start by just letting us know what to you as a consciousness explorer?
Well, yeah, it's changed over the years a little bit. When I was younger, it was more just, it was more about the fun. You know, it was about the, I guess it emerged from my own exploratory experience as a teenager in my early 20s, you know, with psychedelics. And when I first approached practices, I very much was interested in the special effects and the cool spaces you could get into. But as any, you know, good explorer will tell you, the longer you spend exploring, the more the exploration itself starts to sort of change you. And it started to become much more about understanding the dynamics of consciousness more generally, understanding how mental health works, understanding my own challenges and beginning to address them, and then using that understanding to share with other people and kind of pool insights and resources. So now being a consciousness explorer is really just more about what it means to be conscious, what it means to be a human being, how we relate to each other, to the world. I mean, everything is consciousness in the sense that it's the interface through which we meet everything else. So there's nothing that a consciousness explorer doesn't have one toe dipped into, as it were.
Can you describe a little bit about what you've discovered in your consciousness exploration? What are some of these different states that you've encountered?
Yeah, I mean, that's so many. There's so many. It's sort of like where to start. I mean, Head Trip, my first book, was an attempt to kind of describe what I saw as the most basic states of consciousness that were available to us through 24 hours. So it was a lot about sleep and dreaming and some of the borderline states, the hypnagogic and hypnopompic. It was about daydream and trance and the zone, and it was about alertness, and it was about meditation. You can think of those as different locations in a spatial sense. If you think of like a landscape or a house, they're different rooms or they're different terrains. But then as I started getting into meditation, it becomes less about the destinations inside, but there's also the qualities itself we bring to the exploration. So understanding how equanimity works, which is mind-blowing, you know, understanding how concentration works, the way concentration kind of creates reality and unifies the mind, understanding the nature of clarity and discernment and insight, understanding the nature of tranquility, the nature of energy. All those things are now really what I'm most interested in. And that's not surprising, because that's the part that's most directly practical for helping people manage their own inner worlds. So it's really about understanding kind of where are the dials on all those qualities that I described, you know, compassion, where's the dial on that? And how do you turn it up? And in some of them, how do you turn it down? And how do you, what does it mean to have a balanced mind? That's all the stuff I'm super into now.
So that's interesting. You sort of describe the range of states, first starting with more of almost like a neuroscientific approach. Like what do we know about consciousness? We have sleep, we have waking, we can break up sleep into these different aspects. Then you moved into more sort of psychotherapeutic, almost I would say, like talking about somatosensory experience. And then you moved into like a clear Buddhist kind of set of terms that we have. So at the end, the words that we're using were like very defined and very familiar to anybody who has a deep meditation practice: equanimity, clarity, concentration. And so I guess that in some ways reflects your own journey through discovering consciousness, first from a, you know, scientific and now ending up in a more Buddhist perspective.
Yeah, although I wouldn't call it Buddhist, actually. My original inspiration for that was the seven factors of awakening, that Buddhist understanding, a list of seven qualities of sort of mind and heart. And then my teacher, Shinzen, really focuses on, who's Buddhist-ish, on concentration, clarity, and equanimity. But concentration, clarity, and equanimity are, they're not, there's nothing Buddhist about them. They're, and I'm not interested in the Buddhist description of what those things are. I'm interested in a real-time experience that is shared among human beings around what concentration is, what equanimity is, what clarity is. So those, you could say the Buddhist categories first helped me find a way in, but I like to move into different practices outside of any one tradition and then sort of see, okay, what's going on here? How do they describe it? How does science and psychology describe it? How does psychotherapy describe it? You know, and where are they all converging? So Buddhists are, it was a great place to start because it's, they're such awesome list makers, you know, but I would say it's, and all respect to Buddhist practices for sure. I mean, they're the great explorers, you know, but this understanding doesn't belong to any one tradition. I mean, it's really the attempt to try to make it more universal and to say, hey, this is part of our inheritance. It's just like saying, you know, the muscle groups, like, you know, it's like saying a particular tradition discovered that we have biceps or that we have joints or that we have fascia. You know, these are all dimensions of having a human body.
So let's start with one of those and dive into it. Let's really learn. Where would you like to start? Do you want to take concentration, equanimity, clarity, compassion?
People who know me know I'm obsessed with equanimity because I'm so not equanimous, and I wasn't traditionally. It was such a challenge for me. And when I understood what equanimity was, it was so validating. It just helped me understand so clearly a way in which I needed to work in my own experience and what I had been doing in my own experience to manage it, because I have a lot of mental health issues. So that's an easy place for me to go, but maybe a more interesting place to start is with concentration.
So let's dive into concentration. Can you describe what concentration is and what you're discovering about it?
The way I think about concentration is, I mean, I think of it in my own experience as being like focus. It's the ability to pay attention to what I want to pay attention to. And that when we do this, we begin to move into the stream of the thing we pay attention to. So there's a unifying quality to concentration. And that could be contrasted with the way which most of us pay attention and most of us are, quote, concentrated, which is in a very fractured way where we're, so for, if you give the example of you're washing the dishes, you know, we could have a very deep one-pointed experience of washing the dishes, like feeling the water on our hands and all of our faculties converging on this thing. And were we to do that, we would find it's a very deeply pleasurable experience. I mean, that's the, this is what the all the meditative traditions have found. I mean, this concentration is the universal, the foundation, that the act of one pointedly devoting yourself to a single thing is, it creates relaxation in the body and it creates a real kind of ecstatic pleasure in the mind. Because where is the judgment? Where is the boredom? Where is the boredom is something we bring to it. When we get one pointed into it, all those outer worry programs can start to kind of settle and we just have the sensation itself, which is inherently fulfilling. By contrast, most of the time, if we're doing the dishes, we're not really paying attention to what's the water in our hands. We're thinking about our to-do list and we're rehearsing some grudge that bastard said today. You know, we're annoyed by the neighbors who are playing La Bamba on repeat or whatever, but our attention is fractured in all these different directions and it's inherently not satisfying. You know, that this is the thing about concentration. We know what concentration, when it's really well developed, it leads into those flow states that Csikszentmihalyi would talk about, and to being in the zone. I mean, it's like your performance optimizes. There's this satisfaction, this flow, the sense of merging with the world. And all of us will recognize that. Everyone who listening will recognize that there's times when they spontaneously drop into a more absorbed state, whether it's like talking to somebody or they're drawing or they're playing music or they're dancing or they're making love or whatever it is, a sense in which you really are merging with the action. And it's just you can't understand human fulfillment and human pleasure if you don't understand concentration. It's a skill like all the other qualities I would talk about. It's a muscle group. And concentration is also about simplicity. So this more, that sense of simplicity, of simple absorption in our life can begin to flow more into the rest of our life. And it's wonderful. And that's concentration.
That's a really beautiful description of it. I mean, most people who have a meditation practice are familiar with the beginnings of that practice where you focus your attention on your breath, your mind wanders, you notice it and you return. It's the most basic shamatha focused attention practice. And to understand the endpoint that you just described as this total absorption in the moment makes it really, really compelling. And, you know, some of you with meditation practice that's still earlier on, but maybe moving towards intermediate, discovered how delicious it is when you really pay attention to your breath. And when you're doing nothing, but you're there with your breath, I mean, the word that I can only use is delicious.
Absolutely. Blissful is the word, the way the Buddhists and the Hindus talk about it. And it is blissful. It's blissful. It's fulfilling. It's trance, actually, is what it is. It's like when you're in a nightclub and you're just completely fused with the music and your body's moving to it. There's a sense in which you just kind of disappear into the world.
Yep.
And this is, so there's a debate, you know all about this. There's this sort of endless, boring debate with meditators. One group says concentration's great and that's all you need. And then the other group, usually the mindfulness nerds, say, no, you can only get so far with concentration. You know, you can't develop insight with concentration, or you can't get liberated with concentration. It's bullshit. Concentration's a beautiful path. And there are lots of deep yogis who take that path all the way in. What's true is that concentration can be a cul-de-sac. You can get only so far, and it becomes necessary to begin to be more deliberate about some of the other qualities of mind and attention that you bring. And that's where the insight people are right. So maybe that's the next place to go, is to talk about, I mean, there's lots of insight qualities, but clarity is really a central one.
Clarity versus laxity.
Right. Clarity, both clarity in this discernment sense, in the detections, like being able to detect things, and then also the discrimination. So there's the detection, then there's being able to detect the resolution of something. Clarity is really interesting because it's one of the ones that's sort of unique to a mindfulness or an insight path, which is all about not first beginning to get clear about your own habits of mind and reactivity, which are universally valuable to everybody. And then in a deeper sense, beginning to get clear about, at least in a Theravada context, the three characteristics, which would be no self, suffering, and impermanence. There's like two levels of insight or mindfulness practice. There's the beginning level of just becoming aware of what you're doing, aware that your mind is looking at a visual, aware that you're hearing, aware that you're thinking. And then you can go a little bit deeper than there and you start to get aware of the nature of these patterns that pull you away, the nature of thinking and emotions, where they're happening in your experience. And then even deeper than that is you start to deconstruct experience in general. So that's all dead freaking interesting. But that path is a path of kind of developing increasing clarity until you go into this more deconstructing experience. And there's a clear way in which a liberation appears in that mode. And it tends to be more of a path that works well for kind of Asperger's-y dudes, is what I've noticed. Really kind of techie nerd types really like this path, and then basically start to think that that's the standard by which all other paths need to be measured, which is crazy, but that's what happens with nerds.
Can you draw a little bit of a clearer line between the search for clarity and the appreciation of clarity and how it leads to liberation?
Yeah. So clarity is just universally a very useful and helpful skill. It's good to know what's happening in your experience. You know, it's what leads to sanity, to be able to know. I mean, the essence of how clarity is helpful to everyone, it's really the distinction between conscious and unconscious. It's like you can just be operating in the world and someone says something and you react, and someone else says something and you react in this way, and you're just kind of moving along, reacting to the world. You never have any clarity about like what's going on in your own internal world to lead to those responses. So as we start to get clear, we start to get more aware of like, oh, when this person comes in a room, because of my history with them, I immediately start feeling a little bit defensive. And that means, you know, my face gets a little bit tight and I start kind of picturing things they did in the past that annoyed me. So I'm already kind of like a little bit out of sorts. And then I'm going to go into this interaction in a way that's not totally neutral. If we're unconscious, we just sit around and blame them. Oh, that, there's that person. They're determining my reality. If you get a little bit more consciousness, you realize, actually, I'm a partner in this dance. I don't need to respond quite in this way, or I can create these strategies around that. And so there's this growth of sanity as we bring more and more clarity and awareness to our inner world. We start to develop more autonomy and agency. And that's really a big part of what I try to teach people. And that's universally available to anybody. And that's the great gift of mindfulness. And you know, this is why mindfulness is popular now. And it's like, you know, I love it. But of course, there is a deeper, you know, mindfulness is a very deep path. I mean, the path of it's a path of insight. And insight is sort of the one of the traditional ways in which Buddhism explored liberation. But the basics of it is you are practicing and you're noticing when something drops off in your experience. So there's a sound of the bell finishes, you follow the sound of the bell. At the very end, there's a little kind of dip where it disappears, or a big loud sound, boom, clap, you know, it's super loud. And then it drops out. And then you can sort of notice there's a kind of little absence at the end of it. So it's not just the before and after contrast. It's that, you know, sensory experience is a construct. I mean, you know, all this stuff, it's like we're living inside a bubble of our own making. It's just created by, you know, it comes in through
our eyes and our ears and our fingers and creates the perception of reality.
Exactly. So it gets assembled through the various layers of the cortex, and eventually it gets, you know, built into this model, and we think it's reality, and it does a pretty good job of representing reality. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth the bother. But of course, it is just a TV show. And you can start to notice the pixels in the TV show. You start to notice that, oh yeah, this is a construction. And that sounds, that might sound underwhelming, but actually as an experience.
Or terrifying.
But as an experience, it can be deeply liberating.
Yeah.
Because meditation and a deep insight practice is changing your relationship to the bubble of reality. And what we find is when we change our relationship to the bubble of reality, it changes our relationship to the bigger reality. And who knows what the relationship between those two things, but it's pretty darn interesting. And it gets very mystical if I were to go down into the mystical rabbit hole, which I would be happy to do. But just to get back to your question about how insight works. So you start to notice this is a construction, and I can start to see little holes in the construction. Every time the sound disappears, I can start to see that it leaves a little shadow behind it. Or every time I turn my head and the visual world disappears and is reinvented and reemerges in front of me, you can actually start to see that process. So in Buddhism, they talk about the arising and passing, which is this thing of beginning to notice the endless refresh rate of sensory experience, the kind of endless fractal refresh rate of things blossoming and disappearing. And it's wonderful and strange and interesting that this is even possible. And so there's a whole insight cycle, probably best described by Mahasi Sayadaw in his Progress of Insight, about the kinds of insights you get about that constructedness of reality. What I'm focusing on there was just the impermanence part, but there's also the no-self part and the suffering part. The no-self being, as you continue your investigation, you're only ever finding sensation. You're only ever finding things that rise and fall, And you start to look for the you looking, but there is no you looking. There's only, if you're noticing a you, it's just a bit of you that's a sensation that you identified as you. And then that's going away. And you start to go, wait, where's the me? And then tilt. And, you know, you can have one of those tilt kind of classic insight moments from that path. And the suffering, my favorite way this is described is by my friend Daniel Ingram, who's sort of a, you know, controversial fellow in the field, but he's wonderful at describing this. He describes it as a kind of tension, that the suffering is more of a kind of like tension or alienation. It's the way in which the mind-body system is trying to create an artificial observer, an artificial subject over here looking at an observer, and that it's kind of queasy and gross because there isn't one. So it's like this fake thing. And if there's something, as you start to explore that, there's something really uncomfortable about it. And that's one way of talking about the suffering. There's many ways of talking about suffering, but all of these things start to become clear in an insight practice.
Yeah, we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
That's an unconventional way to talk about the suffering. Typically, we talk about the suffering is our desires, and the desires been waning away.
Yeah.
Let's go back for a second, because I feel like there's a moment for the listener to experience some of this. So if you were to, you know, put your hand on your knee right now, you experience the sensation of your hand on your knee. When you then recognize that it's just your perception of your hand on your knee, you then end up in a moment of like, hold on, who or what is the perceiver? If you then stop for a moment and you say, okay, well, I am the perceiver that is perceiving it on the knee, then you go, well, hold on, who is the perceiver that is the perceiver? Do you want to guide us through that for a second or two?
Well, you just did a pretty good job. I went there. Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways into this. Okay, so if you put your hand on something, so you put your hand right here, I'm putting it on this little pillow to the side of me. And so you're putting, and you kind of feel the texture there. And we imagine we're touching a world out there. And no doubt that's true. I mean, we don't really have much to say about the objective world in this exercise. But what we can say is that what you're really touching is you're touching yourself in a way. Your brain is generating sensations that tell you this is what it feels like to touch this texture. It would generate different signals with a different kind of texture, but it's doing the mapping and the creating. You, at no point in your life can you reach your hand through your bubble. You're in your bubble everywhere, always. So that's the first, I mean, that to me is right there a huge insight. Like, oh my gosh, you know, what the WTF. And and as you start to explore it, get really, really interested in the bubble. What is this bubble actually made of? And I don't mean it's made of fabric and leaves and stuff from the world. It's made of consciousness. Like, can you start to notice the pixels or the building blocks of that consciousness? I mean, that's to begin to bring that intention into your practice is to begin to move more deeply into the stream of a more serious insight practice. And it's a wonderful exploration. I don't always think it's the most useful one for deepening a practice for most people, because it's sort of a boutique thing. That's changed from when I was younger, when I was really into it, but it is super cool. And it can lead to an understanding of emptiness, basically, where you realize what's behind consciousness. There's some empty ground. I mean, if you forget about the objective world, but in the subjective world, if everything is made up of your stuff, but if you notice as you get zoomed in that every little bit is kind of arising and passing and disappearing, well, what is it disappearing into? What is that? That's the mystery. That is what leads people into understandings of emptiness. And people who speak from the lived experience of emptiness often it's because they're in direct, immediate relationship with that emptiness. Like Shinzen experiences himself as gushing and disappearing into the emptiness 24/7. That's his experience of reality. It's not mine, but it's how he experiences things.
So what is your experience of reality?
Well, it changes. You know, I'm not a very good insight practitioner. That's one of the things I realize. I don't have, you know, because you have to also have really good concentration. So I've had lots of fun stuff through there. But for me, when things get really cool, it has to always to do with equanimity.
So let's start at the beginning. What is equanimity?
The most useful way that I've heard of it described was from my teacher, Shinzen. And that's how I think about it as it shows up in my experience, although I've kind of taken it in its own direction, as we do. And how he describes it is it's just not pushing and pulling on experience, that it's like the opposite of friction. It's this smoothness in experience of being completely open and from this place of openness, really available to what's going on. And again, it's one of those things that's sort of a negative description. It's maybe best understood with its opposite, which is the state of much more of a kind of frictiony state where we have all these little biases and preferences about how we're operating and all these little ways in which we're kind of like tangled up and fighting with experience. That, you know, it's like, oh, this person's coming in the room and we're kind of bracing and we don't really want to see them, or we don't like the sound and we're trying to kind of push it away, or we really like this food and we're kind of grabbing onto it. And it's like, if you think of like consciousness is just, there's like this fluid film reel that's just smoothly, this river of consciousness that's moving that we are in. But that one of the functions of the mind is to continually try to freeze that stream, to make predictions about it so we can go, oh, I know what's going on. I know what's going on here. So the mind is constantly coagulating the flow of experience. And equanimity is beginning to notice that coagulation and starting to get really, 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 really smooth about it and not fighting. And then, so just to give the listeners an example, we can find it right now in relationship to my voice. You may have been slightly bracing, or you may be slightly going, this weirdo has no clue what he's talking about, which may be true. But instead, I would just invite you to imagine my voice, as well as the ambient sounds in the space around you, to just float right through you. So just soften through the front of the body, kind of get soft in the belly. If there's any kind of startle response, see if you can let that go and just let everything be there. Notice what you did in that moment to just soften or to open. That's equanimity. So equanimity is the openness that's available in experience that we can begin to orient to. For me, it's a continual practice because I have so much fixation and crazy energy. I have to continually go, oh, dude, am I just fixated on something right now? Can I back off and let it go and then let the thing go? And guess what? When you let it go, then the world can update. And you can usually make a much better response than you could before in your fixated place. Because the thing with fixation is it's like we're trying to figure out reality based on an outdated moment, because the moment's passed. Mm. So you're fixated on an idea of what you want to say, but reality is updated. It's over here now and you're way back here. So equanimity is the skill of arriving in the moment again and again. What's the right thing in this moment? What's the right thing in this moment? Refresh, refresh, refresh.
The best definition I've ever heard is simply the state of being perpetually okay. Totally. It's a very simplistic description of it, but it's the state of being perpetually okay, where you don't have wants, you don't have needs, you don't have urges, you don't have frustrations. They may rise and fall, but you let those go and you maintain the perpetual okay.
Right. Well, what I would say around that, that's really interesting. I would say that equanimity is the direction towards perpetual okayness. The equanimity is the space. It's the place, the space around and outside of our condition, which we can learn more and more to be in. And at the beginning, what happens is we get an arising in conditioning. And if it's intense enough, we lose our cool and we end up freaking out, or we end up saying the wrong thing or whatever, you know, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain or whatever it is. As we get more and more experience with that, as we develop more and more equanimity, the conditioning comes up, but our capacity to hold space is a little bit larger, so it doesn't break through. And then eventually, it gets so pain is happening, suffering is, hurt is happening, disappointment is happening, we're getting fired, we're losing our jobs, we're pissed off about Donald Trump, whatever. All that stuff is real stuff, but we have more space around it. It doesn't own us in the same way. But you're pointing to something really interesting, because there is a movement in practice that I think is actually kind of should be talked about more. It's almost like, do we really want to go there? And it's towards being really to that perpetual okayness, where, you know, it doesn't matter what's going on. I'm cool. I'm just be more and more. You could say that you identify more and more with the cosmic or the spacious part of us and not the human part of us. And that is beautiful and liberating, but it's also maybe a bit disturbing. I don't know. I mean, should there be some conversation around this? Is like what we want to go to? I mean, that's what I started. I mean, I talked to Shinzen. He's like, yeah, my problem is not the world of conditions. My problem is taking the world of conditions seriously now. For him, he's just like a big Zen baby, just in his bath of like impermanence bliss, massaging his nerdy brain. But there's tragedies going on, and he's, you know, he responds to it and he cares about it, but less and less. And, you know, maybe that's the direction we should all go, but maybe that's not a direction you want to go as a practitioner, and you don't have to, I guess is what I would say. You should just be clear, though, what direction am I going in? Because otherwise you just pick up someone's ideal that's not yours, and then you're in some weird baloney state of mystical bliss that's not even what you wanted.
So most people, you know, Shinzen aside, getting to the state of completely being unengaged in all of the conditioning around us. For most of us, we are so deeply ingrained in our conditioning, exactly. The practice of equanimity allows us to recognize that conditioning and create space for it. Mm-hmm. And not yell at your kids because you had a bad day at the office, et cetera, et cetera.
Totally. And I would say, and for me, you asked me before, what is my experience like? My experience is that I have more and more, I live more and more in that more spacious place, thank God. And that's what most of my practitioner friends who have experience would say. The space is lush. The space is beautiful. The space is intimacy. It's like there's more and more room to appreciate all the variations of things. And then when those energies of life come through, it's much more of an experience of surfing them as opposed to just responding to them. It's like, well, how do I want to surf this right now? How do I want to roll with this? And then it becomes this more like this fun dance where you can just, someone comes up to you who would normally trigger you, and you can just play, you know, or some situation's happening and you're just like, woo, you're kind of riding it a little bit. And it's really nice. You know, and I can just say that from having years of not been there, I've been so caught up in my own just idiocy and like just grudges and fixations and pain and egotistical nonsense. You know, I'm still working on all those things, but I definitely feel like I have a little bit more room around it. And that's kind of the unexotic place in which practice takes me. There's exotic bits too I could get into, but, you know, that's the more accessible end.
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
Jeff, can you guide us into an experience of equanimity? Can you take us to a place that can allow us to feel a little bit more of that?
Sure. Sometimes I try to use a visualization to kind of get people into the place. So the first one has to do with imagining that you're in the shower. Mm-hmm. And you can do this now. I mean, if you're driving, maybe don't do this.
I'm going to close my eyes and do this with you.
Yeah, close your eyes and just picture you're in a nice warm shower. And it's like, yeah, It's warm. Your pores are open, feeling all relaxed. So there may be a certain amount of natural, when the body's relaxed, there's often more equanimity. So there's a certain amount already there. But where I really want you to notice is in the contrast here that I'm about to give you about what it might look like to actually hold the equanimity piece. Because you're having a shower, but unfortunately you're like, you know, you're in Central America. and there's only like the water tank is like, you know, 2 liters. And so the hot water is just about to finish up and it's about to get really cold. Now think about what you would naturally do as the water's getting cold or gets suddenly super cold. What we naturally do is we brace. So we create this rigidity in our body. Like, I'm going to fight this cold. I'm going to protect myself from this cold. But there's a different strategy, which is to instead completely let go into it. So breathe out, soften through the belly, open. And what would it be like to just be so open to the cold that it wasn't a problem? So you're still in your, in this visualization, you're still in the cold water, but you're not bracing in the same way. You're more open. And just notice, what did you do in that contrast? When I asked you to shift from being bracing, and you can do it again now, brace, really deliberately brace and get rigid, like you're like rocky, you're like a piece of iron. Instead, no, you're just like going to completely be all flabby and open. Let go and let the cold just let it in. And when we do this, we find that the cold's often less of a problem. But it's that little move, that contrast of that opening that I want you to notice. What did you do there, and how does it feel? And if you need to go back to the warm shower, no problem. Go back to the warm. But try to stay with that openness feeling. Where is that? Where do you feel that? People might say, oh, it just feels like being light or space or who knows what. So that's one little thing that kind of orient you to the quality of equanimity or the non-quality. But other people, another one is people are more social, some people. So another one I think of is like, imagine that this little kid, you're in your house and this little kid comes to the door. Doorbell rings, you open the door, and it's like your friend or your neighbor's kid, and they're like talking a mile a minute, and they're all excited, and they're upset about something. What do you right away do to chill the kid out? Like, you start to notice the excitement of the kid in your own body, and then you know you need to be the responsible adult. So you just breathe out and you settle your nervous system. And you say, hey, it's okay. You might put your hand on their shoulder, calm down. You say to the little kid, you know, but you need to embody that. And inevitably there's an equanimity quality that comes in here where you just settle and you open. And notice, so if you're doing that visualization, notice what would you do in your nervous system in that moment, breathing out. Yeah, I'm doing it right now as I talk, just getting chill. So when we open equanimity, we open to the whole experience, but we're so centered and dignified and smooth that we don't get hooked on any part of it. That's what I'm talking about.
That was beautiful. Thank you. Wow. What a lesson in the idea that adversity doesn't have to be adverse. Experience doesn't have to be something that we shy away from, that we can just be in whatever is going on.
Yeah, you can lean right into it. I mean, that's where you start to understand why meditators say your challenges become your gifts. You know, hardship becomes your, becomes a place where that's your edge, where the next level of intensity that you see, can I accept this? Can I be open to this? Can I be equanimous with this? That's the training. It also points to the really deeply, the compassion side of it, which is that this is something you do for the world. Because when you settle in that way, you settle the people around you. And that's why as practice deepens, it starts to have a good influence in this sort of viral mode of everyone around. You have a good influence on the people around you, and then they start to have a good influence on the people around them. And it just goes. And that's maybe the last quality we could talk about, is the compassion quality, because that is one of the beautiful fruits of the practice. Is, you know, compassion is something that both is revealed, the love, the care, the tenderness. It's both revealed as we get more open. It seems to be like a spontaneous response of the human nervous system to that space and to other people. But it's also something you can be deliberate about building, about kind of like what Rick Hansen would say, like going against the brain's negativity bias, like taking moments to find pleasure and appreciation and care for things as a deliberate practice. And so whether it comes from the bottom up or is introduced or just bubbles through as we get more and more open, both of them, they kind of meet and we can deepen that quality. And it's wonderful. It's this feeling, you know, for me of like, there's almost a heartbreak feeling sometimes of just like, oh man, you just are so in, you're so down with everything. And so grateful for it. And you just want to share everything. You want to just bring everybody with you, you know? You're like, hey man, come on. I'm bringing you with me. I don't know if I'm explaining it very well, but there can be this heartbreak feeling that is actually kind of almost pleasurable, even though the situation might be really a downer. You know?
It's the sweetness that's in sadness, the sweetness of humanity.
The bittersweetness, totally.
The sweetness when you feel the connection to a person or a scenario, even though it's sad, you feel your own humanity and you feel their humanity. and the act of being alive and being human and experiencing them this with them, regardless of what it is, no matter how painful, it has a beauty to it because there's the connection through that.
Yeah, that's so well said. Like that.
It's a moment of compassion between us. You let me feel your experience. Thank you, as you described it.
No problem. Ditto.
Thank you for taking us through these qualities of mind. And we definitely had to end on compassion. We couldn't go without compassion because in many ways, perhaps compassion is part of the antidote to Shinzen's uncaring for condition. It is compassion that keeps you coming back and keeps you connected and keeps you wanting to come back and return and help and support everyone around you.
Yeah, I should say with Shinzen, he deeply cares for conditions. He's the most incredible bodhisattva I know. He is about effortless service. It's more like he can't feel conditions in quite the same way. Or he can feel them, but they don't have the same authority. That's the difference. The old reality doesn't have the same authority. What has much more authority for him is the emptiness, you could say. So he's mindful of that. So he kind of works with that edge, even though he's quite a dry and more analytic type person, he's not known for his personal warmth as a teacher. He's pure love. You know, I mean, he lives in love, literally. He's just refreshed moment to moment from that. And he's such a paragon of service. I mean, you call Shinzen up anytime, day or night. Hey, dude, if I had a question, I just call him up. And if he answers the phone, he's ready to serve. If he doesn't answer, then he's not. You know, he can't do it. But that's the kind of generosity that he offers to his students. I mean, he's an amazing guy.
So you've given us amazing practices for the other qualities of mind. Can you perhaps guide us in a compassion practice? So compassion is something that we all know we should have. Sometimes men get a little uncomfortable with the term compassion, I've noticed. They're like, I'm not supposed to be compassionate. That's totally a stereotype that I hope I didn't just accidentally perpetuate. Can you take a minute and guide us into a compassion practice?
Sure. So the different ways to do a compassion practice. I kind of like contrasts in the way that so people can get a flavor for some of the subtleties. And maybe I'll guide one that just contrasts a little bit what I would call a pure empathic response with a compassionate response. And this is something that's come out of, I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's come out of the research in social neuroscience around what people call empathic distress or compassion fatigue. And basically what happens is when we're exposed to lots and lots of people who are stressed and in challenging situations, human beings tend to have some pretty predictable responses. Like either we get overwhelmed, where we're over-empathizing, we're really experiencing their pain. And then because we're experiencing the pain, we start to get really burned out or overwhelmed by it. Or we just go numb and we go kind of neutral. We kind of just go dead. And that's both these are ways in which burnout happens, you know, where we're no longer connected to what's going on.
Yeah.
So what they've done when they've done these studies where they'll get people to look actually at people in distress and they'll ask them with all wired up to feel what it might be like to be that person. And they have these distressing responses, but then they'll say, now contrast this, they'll give them a short training in compassion practice and say, instead of just feeling that person's pain, what if you deliberately intend that person well and try to generate a feeling of warm concern over top of kind of presence and warm concern. And when they do that, it completely changes the experience and it turns out to be create much more resiliency. So this is why smart compassion is so good for resilience in human relationships. And so maybe I'll do a little contrast where I'll get people to visualize, like, not the most triggering thing, but maybe someone you know who's having a hard time. And just feel into that a little bit and just be curious what your own response is. It to start really feeling it, or maybe you just sort of go put down the porticus and just feel like nothing. And then to contrast that with a more deliberate warm practice. So just to see the difference there. And then next time someone's sitting in front of you who's having a challenging time, you can be more deliberate about sending them compassion. So let's try it.
Okay.
So you can close your eyes if that's safe. If you're driving, don't do this. Make it an eyes open compassion for the road. I'll take a couple of deep breaths to start. And just because already talking about this might have stirred some stuff up, maybe nice couple long exhales, softening through the front, finding that equanimity, the openness. Letting my voice be there and floating right through you. And so to start with the contrast, Can you bring to mind someone you know who's having a hard time? Maybe they're just always having a hard time, or maybe they're having going through a specifically hard time right now. And you can kind of visualize their face or just think about them. And for a moment, I'm going to ask you to really empathize here. Kind of really noticing the struggle in their face and really getting kind of intimate with that. And notice what the response is here. As you picture their suffering or think about it, do you start to feel a little bit of hurt yourself, which is very natural? And if so, where do you feel that? I mean, we're doing this really quickly, so this is very artificial.
Well, I'm feeling the hurt.
Okay, so you're feeling it. So pace yourself here. Don't go totally too deep into it. Or you may not feel much. You may just feel like, wow, there's a kind of response, a protective response that comes in when you do that. And that's something that it's also worth noticing. But we're just going to feel it, stay with it for a bit, if that's okay. And then let's switch into something slightly different. I want you to shift into seeing if you can deliberately send that person some warm caring. So instead of just passively feeling what they're feeling, deliberately seeing if you can stoke a quality of like of compassion, of caring for this person, of wanting the best for them. And that's really a combination of being present. So being present, being solid, feeling the ground underneath you. And then generating, intentionally generating a feeling of a caring, whatever that is for you. So it's like you're almost pouring something over the person, like you're sending this thing. Feeling, and again, noticing even this, how will this show up for you? It's going to be different for different people. And also given that this is a bit of an artificial situation, so we're kind of stretching it here, but it may be that you feel warm, that you feel this caring quality, you notice, and if you do, notice where you feel that. Or it may be that as we switch into this for you, it's much more about a kind of calm presence. It's not sentimental in any way. It's more just this immediate presence. And that's also a compassionate response. But this is active, fundamentally active. You could still visualize this person and think about them, but now you're sending them your, and you may have a little phrase you repeat, like, may you be well. That's the classic Buddhist one, but if it sounds a bit stilted, you can use your own version, like, I hope you're okay. Or I'm here, or whatever feels like, you know, whatever is real for you. And the concentration from this practice comes from reestablishing that intention to wish them well and holding that intention in your experience. Noticing what emerges. The equanimity is being okay with it. If it may feel a bit sentimental, but this is what's happening in this moment in reality. You're already here. So just accepting it. And then the clarity is being curious about, well, where am I feeling this? What happens and how does my experience change when I make it more active like this? In this way, we begin to see how any practice practices all our skills. We can learn concentration, clarity, equanimity, even in a compassion practice, maybe especially. So when you're ready, you can open your eyes and tune back into the podcast.
It was beautiful. I wasn't expecting to go there. I wasn't expecting like a full-on, let's eat the suffering of the world compassion practice.
Sorry about that. I didn't know you were going to go there.
It's okay. It's okay. It's full catastrophe living. Let's dive into it. Yeah, I was expecting more of, okay, you know, let's feel some compassion rising in the chest. Let's feel the kindness. Let's smile on another face. But yeah, we went right into the pain and recognized, for me, there was the recognition that when you bring up your own compassion and pile and pour your own compassion on, there's an incredible sense of control that happens. So at first feeling somebody's pain was myself feeling very deep suffering because somebody else was in pain and there's nothing I could do about it.
Yeah.
And that lack of being able to do anything just meant the pain kept piling further and further on me as I experienced their pain with them. And then the ability to bring up the sensation of doing well for them and love for them and compassion for them, something that felt like it could be healing then became this act of me actually being able to act and to have agency and to do something that I hoped would then be able to support the other person. I was no longer at the mercy of the pain. And I think that's something that we learn with a compassion practice when you have compassion for someone else and when you have compassion for yourself.
Definitely. Yeah. And there's a couple of things there. Like, one is you said something really important, you know, and that's that a compassion practice is not about fixing. You know, if you make it about fixing, you think, oh, I can't, this is so, you start thinking about how you're going to help somebody or in specifics, then it becomes in the world of conditions. Like, oh, then is it worth doing? I don't know if I can fix this or not. It's like you offer compassion for its own sake, you know, regardless of what the outcome might be. It's like, so that makes it much more sustainable. You know, you don't focus on the outcomes. You just allow yourself to feel it for its own sake. And that's an important thing to kind of understand when you're doing the practice. Like, otherwise you start to have to go this whole thing in your head about whether, oh, is this going to actually work, or how can I actually do this? And that's one thing. And then the other thing is just when you're doing these practices, I mean, that's why normally you go right to the warmth, and that's what's going to create resilience. But I did a thing where I got to go into a little bit of feelings and challenge. And that is something when you're going into thinking about other people's challenges or working with your own challenges, it's really important to pace yourself. And normally if I were to leave a practice like that, I would have a little bit more of an intro where I would get people to resource themselves a little bit and then kind of go into it. And this is what we're learning from the whole world of trauma sensitive mindfulness that's emerging around not, if you're going to work with difficult experiences, that learning first how to find a kind of home base in your experience and then how to kind of titrate in, where you go in a little bit and then you pull back and you go in a little bit more and you pull back. And that's a way in which you can sort of care for yourself and pace your own moving into that, because otherwise you can get kind of overwhelmed. So thanks for giving me an opportunity to mention that.
Thank you for guiding us in there. It was beautiful. No, so thank you very much for this beautiful talk altogether and guiding us through various conditions inside the mind. I hear you have some upcoming retreats.
Yeah, I have a retreat outside of Toronto for Canadians or anyone who wants to come close. Nowadays, I get more Americans coming up too. And I'm really interested in mixing sitting practice with movement practices. So there's going to be some cross-country skiing and snowshoeing in addition, but it's very much about a nice chill retreat, you know, do some meditation. It's on my website. And then there's even more dynamic movement one happening in Costa Rica in March with my friend Scott Davis, who's an amazing natural movement teacher. So these are the kinds of things I'm into now, is like doing kind of synergistic, exploring practices, mutual practices, like bringing movement into it, bringing artistic endeavor into it, and then seeing how the skills are built across the different practices. So if that sounds interesting to you, yeah, those are two things coming up.
So whether you're into the cold or you're into the warm, if you're into Jeff's voice, there's a place you can be with him. Well, thank you very much for your generosity and for taking us through these various states of mind. Thank you for this time together.
Yes, my pleasure, Arielle. Thanks for having me on.
If you want to find out more about Jeff's amazing work, his website is jeffwarren.org, JeffWarren.org. You can also find the show notes with details about his meditation retreats and books at arielgarten.com. That's me, arielgarten.com. If you want support learning or strengthening your concentration meditation practice, Muse is actually extremely helpful. It gives you real-time feedback, letting you know when you're concentrating and when your mind is wandering, and helping you remain in concentration for longer and longer periods of time. Muse is offering a discount code, Untangle15, UNTANGLE15. You can use it at choosemuse.com for 15% off. Next week, Patricia will be back with more Untangle. Till then, keep your neurons sparkling.